When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
U.S. Special Forces launch a major overnight raid in Syria, targeting a high-level terrorist leader. Plus, the Kremlin calls the deployment of U.S. troops to Europe a destructive and escalatory step. And President Biden faces a growing chorus demanding executive action on student debt.
There's some acknowledgement of the administration that these people are ignored at the president's peril.
It's Thursday, February 3rd. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. U.S. Special Forces have carried out a major overnight raid in northwestern Syria. Our Middle East correspondent Sunet Rasmussen says gunships, airstrikes, and drones were used to target a high-level terrorist leader.
Footage on social media showed two or three helicopters landing in the area and surrounding a residential building. Then U.S. troops demanded through a loudspeaker that women and children vacate the building. The raid seems to have lasted for more than 2 hours and resulted in multiple deaths. The raid took place in an area called Atme, which is in Idlib province near the border with Turkey. And it's an area that for a long time has been a stronghold of jihadist opposition groups in Syria, including a group called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham that used to be allied with al-Qaeda.
President Biden is expected to address the military operation later this morning. Russia has called the deployment of more than 3,000 American troops to bolster the defense of European allies a destructive step. In a letter to his counterparts in the U.S., Canada, and a number of European countries, Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said there are significant differences in the understanding of Europe's security architecture. He argues that a 1999 agreement signed by several EU and NATO members means that no state or organization can hold primary responsibility for maintaining peace and stability in Europe. Lavrov has asked several foreign ministers to individually answer how their countries understand those obligations. The EU will discuss a joint response at a meeting today. President Biden's congressional agenda, including confirmation of his planned Supreme Court nominee, could now face delays following the hospitalization of Senator Ben Ray Lujan. The New Mexico Democrat remains hospitalized after suffering a stroke last week, and while Lujan's staff say he could return to work within 4 weeks, his absence leaves Senate Democrats with only 49 votes in the chamber. As a result, several Senate committees, of which Lujan is a member, have already postponed hearings to advance nominees for the Federal Communications Commission and the Federal Trade Commission. And airlines have canceled thousands of flights as a potentially dangerous winter storm advances across the central and eastern U.S. Flight disruptions are expected to be most severe at Dallas-Fort Worth and Chicago's O'Hare airports. The storm comes on the heels of Wednesday's Groundhog Day festivities, when noted weather forecasting rodent Punxsutawney Phil predicted 6 further weeks of winter. Early on in the pandemic, American spending habits changed dramatically. Unable to dine out or take a vacation, they hunkered down and spent their dollars on goods like furniture and computers. Federal stimulus made those purchases even easier. But now, American spending patterns could be shifting once again, with potentially significant implications for the economy. Here with that story is Journal reporter Harriet Torrey. Harriet, welcome.
Hi.
Take us into this latest data that you're seeing and what shift in spending might be underway now.
Yes, what we're seeing in consumer spending is that the share of spending on durable goods is beginning to slip slightly. So when we talk about goods, we mean things like clothing and food, things that you would use up relatively quickly. Durable goods are things that are more expensive, let's say a new washing machine, a new phone, a new car, things like that. And what we saw in the pandemic is that sales of durable goods went through the roof. So we saw this big big jump in spending on goods while spending on services really sort of declined or flatlined. And we're beginning to see that shift, which is interesting because services spending does make up the lion's share of personal consumption expenditures, which in turn are, you know, a real driver of the US economy. So it's definitely a good sign that we're seeing more spending on services.
Of course. I do wonder, though, does this shift in spending take into account the effects of the Omicron variant yet?
The middle of December is when the Omicron variant really hit, and that did dent spending, and it really has taken a toll on the economy, not just in December, but also we're beginning to see in January as well. Looking at the real-time data, we saw a lot of drops in spending on categories like travel, dining, those discretionary categories where in order to go out and spend on those things, people need to feel confident about not getting infected with the virus. But the hope is that in the next few months, the weather will start to get warmer. People might feel more comfortable dining outdoors, socializing outdoors, and that will help build confidence and get people spending on services again.
Okay, so this shift is likely to continue, but I wonder if this is a full-blown return to the traditional spending balance or if there's still more at play here.
Largely, yes. Of course, we just saw a lot of disruption due to the pandemic, and then not just that demand increase for goods, but we also saw a lot of shortages of products. There have been backlogs at ports because demand suddenly ramped up, but due to so many different pandemic-related reasons, it just took time for a lot of bottlenecks to sort of unwind. And we began to see that in the fourth quarter. Overall, what we're looking at would be a return to normal. But of course, what we've seen in the pandemic is that normal has changed a lot.
Right. So that return to services spending, what could that mean for the wider economy?
So what we have seen, of course, over the past year is a huge increase in inflation. One thing that has been driving that is this increased demand for goods, because goods inflation has picked up much more quickly than services inflation. I mean, don't get me wrong, services inflation has gone up as well, as I'm sure people notice. You go out to eat and the price of a meal has really jumped, or price of your haircut has gone up because of services inflation. But goods inflation has been very, very, very sharp. And the hope is that as things start to get back to normal, that more spending on services will take the edge off this inflation in goods and hopefully balance things out somewhat.
That was Journal reporter Harriet Torrey. Harriet, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, with President Biden's agenda bogged down in Congress, some of his supporters are being increasingly vocal in calling for him to take sweeping action to reduce or even eliminate student debt. We've got more on that after the break.
Robert Half research indicates 9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring. Robert Half is here to help. Our recruiting professionals utilize our proprietary AI to connect businesses with highly skilled talent. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
During his campaign for president, Joe Biden pledged to reduce or eliminate student debt for millions of Americans. Here was an ad his campaign ran in the final days before the election.
Debt really hinders the social progress of so many American families. The fact that Joe Biden wants to forgive student debts is something I'm excited about voting for him.
Biden's plans, however, relied on congressional action in order to get done, a task made increasingly difficult by the partisan divides in Congress. Now, frustration on the part of some of Biden's supporters is simmering. For more on this story, we're joined by WSJ White House reporter Andrew Restuccia. Hey, Andrew, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Andrew, during his election campaign, Biden pledged to cancel $10,000 in student debt for borrowers. Is that promise now effectively dead in the water?
Pretty much, yeah. The president's, I guess he wasn't the president then, the then candidate Joe Biden promised during his campaign that he would forgive about $10,000 in student loan debt for every borrower. That, he said, he would like to do through legislation, not through executive order. And there's been legislation floating around in Congress to do that. But given the really narrow margins in Congress and the deep sort of political divides on this issue, it's not seen as moving anytime soon through Congress.
Okay, so what has President Biden managed to do thus far to live up to some of his other campaign promises on student debt?
Sure. So there are a couple pandemic-related relief programs that are in place, the biggest of which is an overall pause on the payment of federal loans. That started under the Trump administration, and President Biden has continued it. It's set to expire in May. And so that's giving some people who, you know, have quite large loan payments some heartburn and concern about what happens after May. But certainly for more than a year now, nearly 2 years, people haven't had payments, or they're not required to make payments on their loans. Separately, the administration has also overhauled several programs that allow for forgiveness in more narrow cases, including for people who work in public service jobs. So if you work for the government, for example, you can, if you make a certain number of payments over time, you can have the rest of your loans forgiven. It's also for people with disabilities and people who went to certain for-profit colleges that have been deemed, that have come under criticism from some outside groups for their loan practices.
So who is pressuring the White House to get more done, Andrew, and what exactly are they hoping for?
During the presidential campaign, there was this sort of swelling movement from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party to forgive student debt on a large scale. It's led by people like Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. She is calling, and as are other progressive Democrats, calling on the president to forgive $50,000 or up to $50,000 in student debt per borrower. That's much larger than the $10,000 per borrower that the president has talked about. Joe Biden has expressed some skepticism and said that he's limited in what he can do and he'd rather see it through Congress. Elizabeth Warren and many others who on her side of this equation think that it can be done through executive order and that the president can, with his pen, essentially wipe away billions of dollars in debt.
Just backing up, what is the economic argument being made for wiping out federal student debt?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, erasing this debt would have a cost to taxpayers. Something like $1.6 trillion is the overall cost of all federal student loans right now. But Warren and others argue that this would boost the economy in many ways by freeing up wealth, people's spending habits, and allowing them to spend money on other things that would boost the economy in a more effective way, from mortgages to groceries to so many other things. And especially during the pandemic, people have often struggled to pay their basic bills. So the idea is that this would inject fresh capital into the economy and have some economic benefits.
Right. But your reporting also seems to suggest that the potential upside of debt forgiveness is somewhat limited, is it not?
Yeah, there's a lot of different research on who would benefit from this. There's quite a bit of research that shows that Black borrowers in particular tend to hold their debt for much longer. And so forgiving debt would certainly help Black people across the country who have debt and are struggling paying it off. But overall, there have been also some studies that show that the sort of bulk of this student loan debt is held by wealthier households. So the question is, who is benefiting in what way? And yeah, and obviously there are political considerations to take into account there too.
Got it. So is part of the reason the White House may not be swayed by arguments in favor of debt cancellation that they just don't see a political benefit there?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of disagreement in the White House about the people in the administration have acknowledged that there's a pretty powerful voting bloc behind this debt forgiveness initiative for this Gen Z, young millennial voters, you know, people who in the past sometimes haven't always shown up at the polls, but if they do, it's a pretty powerful block of people. And so I think there's some acknowledgement in the administration that these people are ignored at the president's peril. But independents are a little bit more unsure and Republicans are much more skeptical of this sort of endeavor. And I think there's some concern that there might be blowback, especially among people who have already paid off their loans and feel like, hey, it's not fair. I didn't get a break. Why are all these people getting help?
That was WSJ White House reporter Andrew Rastusha. Andrew, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
And finally,
3, 2, 1. We have booster ignition and liftoff of the Space Shuttle Endeavour with the first American element of the International Space Station uniting our efforts in space to achieve our common goals.
That was the sound of the Space Shuttle Endeavour blasting into orbit to begin assembling the International Space Station back in 1998. But after more than 30 years of conducting cutting-edge research, the end of the ISS mission is in sight, and NASA has announced plans to decommission it within a decade. It plans to take the ISS out of orbit in January 2031 before crashing it into what's known as the Spacecraft Cemetery in the most remote point of the Pacific Ocean in a fitting and likely fiery farewell. After that, the agency says it expects the private sector to pick up where the ISS left off. And that's What's News for Thursday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.